Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Whitney Asset Management Economic Update Call. The information and opinions expressed on this call are those of the individuals who made the statement and do not necessarily reflect the policies, views, opinions, and positions of Hancock Whitney Bank. Hancock Whitney makes no representation as to the accuracy, completeness, timeliness, suitability, or validity of any of the information presented. This information is general in nature and is provided for educational purposes only. Information provided and the statements made should not be relied on or interpreted as accounting, financial planning, investment, legal, or tax advice. Hancock Whitney Bank encourages you to consult a professional for advice applicable to your specific situation. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Strategist Paul Teton and Investment Directors Richard Chauvin, Martin Serrera, and Jeffrey Tangus. Our Chief Investment Officer, David Lundgren, is unable to join us today, so Investment Director Steve Morgan will be facilitating our discussion. Steve came to Hancock Whitney in the acquisition of Capital One's wealth and asset management business, where he was the Director of Investment Solutions. He has over 23 years of investment experience and holds a bachelor's in mathematics from Carleton College and a master's in mathematics from University of Wisconsin. And with that, I'll pass it on to Steve.
Great. Thanks, Ashley, and thanks to everybody for joining us this morning. The news flow has blessed us with a pretty full roster of topics to talk about in Dave's absence, and geopolitics is probably at the top of the list. So, Richard, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Steve. Doing well.
Great. Let's start with what's been kind of the biggest hit for the past several months, U.S.-China trade relations. Can you bring us up to speed with the latest twists in that particular topic?
Sure can. So there's been some preparations for the next round of negotiations. Some lower-level negotiating teams have met a couple of weeks ago to sort of prepare the table for higher-level negotiations by the typical team that's been carrying out these negotiations, and that would be Chinese Vice Premier Liu He, Steve Mnuchin, who's the Secretary of the Treasury, and Robert Lighthizer, who's been the U.S. Trade Representative. They're planning to meet in Washington, D.C. on October 10th. Their plan is to hopefully have Presidents Trump and Xi meet in November and hopefully to have some kind of agreement. I'll just add that the tone of the negotiations or the preparations for negotiations have been more conciliatory in recent weeks and as compared to earlier in the summer. There's been an effort to de-escalate the situation to kind of calm things down. And this might involve some kind of agricultural purchases for the Chinese and maybe the U.S. canceling some tariffs that are in place or about to be in place. That's a quick summary of the situation.
Great. Thanks. And you know, we talk about de-escalation, but in the last few days, we've really heard some news stories around restrictions on Chinese stocks trading on U.S. Markets, potential restrictions of investments and government employee pensions, et cetera. Why is that topic really coming out now in the middle of apparent de-escalation, and what authority does the president really have in this arena?
Yeah, it's really not a new issue. It hasn't been in the news for quite some time. There has been an effort in place to impose the same financials and disclosure requirements on Chinese companies that list on U.S. exchanges as U.S. companies are required to have. Some of the restrictions that have now been discussed more publicly is potentially delisting Chinese stocks on the U.S. exchanges if they don't meet certain reporting standards, and possibly limiting the pension investments of federal employees that currently flow into Chinese securities. So those are the two options being discussed. The reasons why this might have come out at this unusual time is, I think, rather curious. It's likely that these discussions that have been ongoing were leaked by the hardliners in the administration who are seeing this de-escalation process and are observing that President Trump seems to be warming to some kind of interim deal, and they're not happy with that that direction. So and to answer to your second question, the president has pretty broad authority under the act known as the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. And in this act, if he decides to declare a national emergency related to some kind of a threat that he sees to either national security, foreign policy, or the economy, he can then regulate or prohibit certain types of foreign economic transactions, including the flow of goods, currency or credit exchanges. So that's where he would get power to make these types of decisions.
Great. And how does it fit into the overall picture of U.S.-China trade negotiation?
Well, you may remember that there was a pretty comprehensive agreement back in April that China was it looked like we were about to have a deal. But at this point in time, after all the back and forth, China refuses to go back to the text of that agreement. It's pretty much thrown out in their view. So this new proposal is really designed, this proposal about the security restrictions is designed to increase the pressure on China. You could kind of see it as a third weapon by the U.S. in the trade war. We've currently got the tariffs as one weapon, tech restrictions such as those on Huawei, the big tech conglomerate in China, and now potentially a financial war. Senator Rubio from Florida has introduced legislation that would basically require Chinese companies to comply with U.S. disclosure rules if they're going to list on U.S. exchanges, but he'd give them 3 years to do so, which seems pretty reasonable. Probably what's not as likely is some kind of an immediate delisting requirement, which would be pretty disruptive. Anyway, this news of potential restrictions has further weakened the Chinese currency, the yuan, and which is actually counter to what Trump wants to do to reduce the trade deficit. This actually accomplishes the opposite.
Great. So your default outcome for the past few months, I think, has been really no deal on the U.S.-China trade front. Is that still the outcome you're expecting?
You know, actually, I don't think the same way now as I did last month. Last month, I did say I expected no deal, but conditions have really changed. So, I don't think that's really applicable at this point.
So what's changed? Is it impeachment or something else at work?
Well, it's the impeachment inquiry that's really the big change, I believe. I think it's reasonable when you think about it that with the impeachment inquiry now underway, it's more likely that Trump will seek a smaller interim deal because he needs to rev up his base of support. And as we've heard before, these tariffs have put pretty big strains on farmers and other businessmen in the economy. So if he can show them something that relieves that that tension on them, that hardship, he can rev up his base, and that will help him in his efforts to kind of lambast the Democrats in Congress over this whole impeachment inquiry.
Well, that makes sense. Now, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the NAFTA 2.0, looked like it might be coming to a conclusion. Is it improving, or is impeachment affecting it as well?
It did look pretty good up until just a couple of weeks ago. The odds of a passage seem to be going up. But I think overall, I think this impeachment inquiry is going to slow or stop a lot of legislative efforts. So I think the odds look less likely right now. The one caveat to that, I would say, would be if President Trump decides to apply some leverage and can do so effectively, he might could get the wheels turning on this issue. Because if he is effective in explaining to the voters that Congress is harming the livelihoods of auto workers and farmers by not, you know, ratifying this agreement that's already been ratified by Mexico and Canada, then perhaps he can make them act.
Great. So one agreement looks a little better, one looks a little worse, but both dependent on kind of the court of public opinion, which makes sense.
That's
turning
true.
Turning a little bit further afield, big news earlier in the month was an attack on a Saudi oil facility that really moved oil prices for at least a couple of days. What concerns does that raise for you?
Well, it's been pretty unpredictable. The general belief was after this attack that there would be, there was a quick increase in oil prices on the loss of supply, as well as the belief that the vulnerability of the supply was greater than expected, and therefore there would be a premium attached to the price for some ongoing period of time. But now prices have returned pretty much back to the mid-$50 range on the West Texas Intermediate crude. So that's a little curious. The oil supply was impacted. It is still impacted, but the Saudis have said they believe they can restore half the production within a couple of weeks, and the market has calmed down. It seems that also I think that plays into this, the rhetoric about physical retaliation, some kind of kinetic action, has calmed, and that the U.S. seems to be more interested in just increasing the financial sanctions on Iran. So I guess I would say, in my opinion, the oil markets do seem to be underestimating the ongoing risk to Mideast oil supply, but it is notable that the oil prices are probably benefiting from the fact that U.S. economy is now such a large producer, which, provides substitute supply in cases like this.
And probably good for the U.S. economy as well, given that we're such a big producer.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a good point, Steve, that modest increases in supply now are probably more beneficial to the economy in terms of capital spending and making the industry healthy, and that's more than offsets any negative effect on the consumer.
Right. So, all right, fantastic. Some, I guess, known unknowns to keep our eye on there in the Middle East. We started with one of our big hits, U.S.-China trade. Let's switch back to one of the longer-term big hits, Brexit. Looks like we're coming up right around the corner of a deadline. What's happening there?
Yeah, it's so many twists and turns, it's hard to keep up with, Steve. But so recently, and certainly over the past month, Boris Johnson, the U.K. Prime Minister, suffered a defeat in his highest court when they ruled that his suspension of Parliament was determined to be illegal, and so Parliament is back in session. Now, he had prorogued or suspended Parliament in an effort to keep them from fighting him on the Brexit exit by the October 31 deadline. They are now back in session, trying to work on a way to stop him from having a hard Brexit, as we call it. He is negotiating with the EU on an ongoing basis. I think they meet weekly, but there seems to be pretty low confidence that an alternate deal acceptable to all the parties is out there to be found. This has been going on for 3 years. So Parliament has been preventing Johnson from calling any snap election, which he has called for at times to change the makeup of Parliament. But it seems like at some point that's likely the solution to this, is to have an election and sort of reset the table of who's supporting it and who's against it. But it's interesting, a large number of parliamentarians really do not want that election, because it's pretty clear that the polls still say that the Brexiteers would win and that the remainders would lose. So it's kind of understandable they would try to prevent that election from happening. If they can find a way to get Johnson out of office in some way, they'll do it. Otherwise, I think what we look for is an election's going to happen at some point, and there'll eventually be a Brexit, but it probably won't happen by October 31. It might happen sometime early next year.
Ideal. Thank you very much, and thanks, Richard. Let's set politics aside for at least a moment and turn to the numbers a little bit. Good morning, Paul. How are you?
Hey, I'm fine. Thank you, Steve.
Great. Our base case, I think, for the end of 2019 was a 2 to 2.5% real GDP range. Where do we stand on that?
We're pretty much the same. 2 to 2.5 has been sort of our projected range for GDP for a while now for this year. It's not a particularly heroic forecast, because that's pretty much where growth is. We tend to use the year-to-year percent change in GDP as more of a trend indicator than the quarterly quarter-to-quarter numbers, which can have a lot of noise in them. And that's pretty conventional to kind of get a good handle on GDP growth. So the backdrop is that year-to-year growth in GDP peaked in the spring of 2018 at 3.2%, which was the best growth we had achieved since the crash in 2008. We've been pretty much stuck in a 2% kind of track on GDP the whole decade. The tax cuts that went into effect in early 2018 really kind of stimulated some capital spending and just kind of really revved up the economy a little bit anyway to get to that 3.2% rate. So it was in the spring, summer when the tariff war sort of became one of the dominant factors on the scene, pretty much threats at that time, but started to be implemented last year. And so since then, GDP growth has trailed off to currently running around 2.3% year-to-year through the second quarter. So we just got the third update on the second quarter last week. So the pattern is they'll start to release numbers on the third quarter late this month, and then for the next couple of months, update things. So we do try to handicap what the current quarter number is going to be, and we think it's probably closer to 2 than 2.5, reasons being that consumption has slowed noticeably here in the last month or two, and that's been the driver of pretty solid growth, healthy, you know, 2.5% kind of growth in the last quarter or two. And so that looks to be flagging a little bit, which is a pretty good warning sign that we're on alert for a continued headwind from the trade war. And think that the downshifting in growth from 3.2 to 2.5, say 2.3, is largely a function of a slowdown in capital spending and the uncertainty relating to the trade war. So we're watching closely for signs that things are slowing further, and there is a little bit of that. Just this morning, the Institute for Supply Management released their Manufacturing Purchasing Managers survey, and it was a disappointment at 47.8 versus 49 previous month. Construction spending was light at only 0.1% growth in August. So we're starting to see a lot of signs that maybe things are slowing a little further. We had thought that there was a pretty good case that with the consumer looking pretty strong, that growth could accelerate a little bit in the third quarter, maybe towards 2.5, and start up a little bit of a manufacturing rebound. So manufacturing has been kind of sluggish all year. And we did get a little bit of that in August, but the signs are that maybe that's going to fade. This Friday will be a release for the non-farm employment survey, and so that'll be another critical variable. Labor growth has been healthy, but there are some signs of that labor utilization is also flagging a little bit. So long story short, we're sort of guiding our expectation toward the lower end of that 2 to 2.5% range for the third quarter.
Okay. So definitely sounds like some less inspiring numbers, although not a worst case by any means. What if we shift abroad again, and we've heard some updates about the developments in the geopolitics, but what does growth look like in Europe and in China?
Well, it's not good in Europe. It looks like Germany is slipping into recession, and Germany is really the driver of growth in Europe. We're concerned about that, and growth in Europe I guess like ours peaked out around 3% last year. Theirs peaked out only around 2%, and they have decelerated toward about 1% growth. So, you know, they're getting a little bit close to the zero line there overall in the Eurozone, and that's a concern. China is a little bit more of a challenge, more opaque than Europe and the U.S. in the way that they share data with the world. Although, since they have opened up their economy in the last 20 years, they do report a lot to the press. And what we can see is they are having a slowdown as well to what we would consider pretty solid growth, around 6%. But that's down from 12 a few years ago. So it's really, they're highly leveraged to world trade, which has been slowing thanks to the tariff war. So their economy is a little wobbly. The signals are a pretty sluggish economy for them. So global growth continues to slow down towards around 3%, maybe a little under, which is that's considered sort of the borderline between being concerned about recession and not. So recession concerns for Europe are high. Recession concerns for China are not high. And that's sort of an X factor that we just don't know how to handicap. In the last 30 years that they've been sharing economic data with the world, they've never had a recession. So if they were to have one, nobody has any idea what that looks like or what it means. It would be a pretty, it would be a source of uncertainty and risk aversion for sure, but we're not calling for that. It doesn't look like that's happening. It just that's kind of what we're keeping our eye on.
Great. And I know we've had a couple of internal chats about this, but can you give just a moment's color around what might be driving that slowdown in Germany?
Well, thanks. That's a good question, and I do get that in conversations. I think it's a little obscure, the connection between Germany's slowdown and the trade war. But essentially, it amounts to the fact that Germany, their competitive advantage is they make high-end capital goods, and they export that stuff all over the world. And so one of the chief fallouts of the trade war is that capital investment planning has been frozen pretty much everywhere as people wait to see how this is going to play out, if the supply chain will be moving from China or what. And so that uncertainty has really cut into export orders for Germany, and their manufacturing sector is really feeling the pain. It's the connection there.
That makes sense. And recession watch high in Europe and kind of on not as high in China, but is it even a slowdown or a recession in any of those places drive thoughts about recession here in the U.S.?
I'd say generally recession concerns here are not high. They're not zero, but at, you know, kind of steady 2-ish percent growth, really not a lot of imbalances in the U.S. economy. There's nothing that's really obvious that is out of whack that needs to be corrected in a recession or some kind of economic correction, unlike 2007 when the residential housing market was clearly overbought, overpriced, and over-leveraged. So those kind of extreme situations are a little bit hard to find here, and certainly not to that kind of degree. If Europe goes into recession, it's certainly going to be a headwind for growth here, and so we could drift below 2% growth towards 1.5%, which would be worrisome, but not really high alert recession concerns here. And as I've said, China is sort of got some black swan potential to it. Just nobody knows what that means. I'm happy to report we don't think it's likely there, but if that were to play out, we would have to be on point and ready to react, but that's fortunately not the case.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I Can't hardly mention the recession word, the R word, without thinking about the Fed. And Jeff, we'll turn to you for that. The Federal Reserve met in September and cut rates to help keep that sort of growth up above the 2%, we hope, level. After the meeting, we're hearing a lot more about a split Fed. What does it mean? Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, good morning, Steve. Good morning, listeners. I guess we'll get to a little inside baseball on the Fed and kind of how it works to explain what the split Fed means. Essentially, there are 10 voting members on the Federal Open Market Committee that decide the direction of Fed activity. Those people, along with the non-voting members, all are surveyed every quarter. And the survey, which has become known as the dot plot, shows how each member feels at that point about the future, the appropriate future of the Fed funds rate, and sort of indirectly how they would intend to vote. So split just means that there are different opinions among those, especially the 10 voting members, as to how they might vote at the next Fed meeting. And those opinions are certainly about the direction and the timing and the magnitude. And sometimes they want to cut or raise more than one notch of 25 basis points. So there's a lot of moving parts that goes into that. But essentially split Fed means you have a lot of very smart people on the committee that have different opinions. They're all from different backgrounds around the country. And so sometimes they agree on the appropriate course of action, and then sometimes, like right now, they have the situation is a little more complicated. Paul talked about slowing global growth while we still have very low inflation and great employment here in this country. So it's complicated right now. So it's not hard to understand why there's some different opinions as to why some people think we should cut rates more and some people think we shouldn't cut rates more. Right now, as it stands, 5 voting members believe interest rates should be cut again before year end, and 5 believe that no cut before year end is appropriate. So that's not really good or bad. It just shows you that there is some diversity of opinion. Sometimes you want a strong consensus, especially if the economy is too hot or too cold. You want a strong consensus showing good, clear leadership. Right now, though, it's okay to have some differing opinions because they're well-founded. Does that make sense?
It surely does, and I'm going to ask you to handicap a little bit here with the split Fed. What's the likely course between here and the end of the year?
Well, the path of least resistance is one more cut in December. Right now, we know from the Fed Funds futures market that investors generally think that there's a 70% probability that the Fed cuts before year end. We also know Chairman Powell and the Vice Chair Clarita both favor a cut. So two heavyweights, voting heavyweights, believe a cut is warranted. So they really just need to flip one of the votes right now who think that rates should stay the same. And with the weakness that Paul's talked about earlier, that shouldn't be too hard. So in all likelihood, there'll be another cut before year end.
Great. Makes sense. You know, the oil markets weren't the only group that had an unexpected event during the month. We heard a little bit of news about the repo market spiking. Can you explain a little bit about what that looks like and what the likely outcomes are?
Well, the repo market is kind of one of those arcane corners of the financial world. It's where large financial institutions borrow money from other large financial institutions overnight. They're one-day loans. They're collateralized. They're very safe. Banks have excess reserves that they have cash laying around. Other financial institutions, say a Goldman Sachs or a Merrill Lynch, owns a lot of securities that they have to own as far as inventory and have to finance. So the repo markets are really the mechanism that those large financial institutions lend and borrow overnight in a very safe and secure manner. So important, but not something that the average person on the street would really bump into a lot.
And why are those rates spiking?
Well, at quarter end, there's always a demand for cash. There's big financial institutions do something we call window dressing. They'd like to, people like to see lots of cash on balance sheets, and so there's always a demand for short-term, we call it cash, which is funded through the repo markets. This time, because of a confluence of several unusual events, Treasury bond sales and some Dodd-Frank rules, just a bunch of technical things, there was a little more demand than usual. And quite frankly, the Fed was caught off guard. And normally the Fed is there. They can, with a couple of the programs or tools that they have at hand, they can inject a lot of cash or liquidity into the financial system. They were just a little late, asleep at the switch, if you will. So they, once they realized that they came in with some of their programs and got things back in line. So, and you know, during that period, overnight repo rates spiked up to as high as 10% because people had to have that money and were willing to pay, because it's only one day, they were willing to pay those larger interest rates just to get them. Once you get past a quarter, though, things generally calm down, which they already have.
Great. I think the Fed's got their eye on the ball for the future events like this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, perfect. All right, real quick. We hear that Mario Draghi at the European Central Bank is potentially retiring this month. What is the likely outcome for that, and what does it mean for European monetary policy and U.S. rates?
Yeah, it's a changing of the guard in Europe. They have their issues, as Paul talked about, again, from an economic standpoint. Mario Draghi is, I think he's been the ECB president, chairman since 2011. Christine Lagarde is coming in from the IMF, International Monetary Fund. So she's a known entity. She generally supports the loose monetary policies of Mario Draghi. So there's not expected to be much of a change in policy under her leadership. She actually takes over in November. So in Europe, rates will continue to be either very low or negative, as they are in most of the countries in Europe now, in the Eurozone. And as far as the impact on U.S. rates, the fact that rates are so low in Europe will have the effect of keeping a lid on rates here in the United States. It's tough for our rates to rise a lot, especially given the slowing economy, when rates there are so low. Capital flows across the Atlantic to the United States and into our Treasury markets, keeping our rates low. So it's gonna make our rates lower for longer as well.
And that makes sense. Thank you very much, Jeff Martin. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Let's take a little bit of a look at the equity markets. We started September off pretty strong, but gave a little bit up at the end. What was driving them during September?
Well, it's actually been a pretty interesting month and a pretty interesting quarter. So at the end of the month, equity returns were pretty good for the month. The S&P 500 stocks were up almost 2%. Mid-cap and small-cap stocks were up 3%. Non-U.S. stocks and developed markets were up 2% or so. Even emerging market stocks were up about 2%. But the quarter returns are a lot different, and that kind of goes into your question. For the full quarter, S&P 500 was up 1.7%. So it was down or flat going into the beginning of September. And really what happened was there was a big sell-off in August caused by a couple of different scares that we've talked about recently, and then a rebound. So yes, September started off with a little bit of a bang, but then just kind of meandered along through the rest of the month as nothing really shook the market after the beginning of the month. another couple of interesting viewpoints of the of recent results. For the month of August, utility and financial stocks were up over 4%, while commercial services companies, media companies, internet retailers, companies like that were flat for September. And then finally, there's been a sort of a big change recently that value stocks have been outperforming growth stocks. So for the month of August, the S&P 500 value index was up well over 3%, about 3.5%, while the growth index was basically flat, and that's a big switch from what's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, heard a little bit about that, a few articles hitting the news wires on that shift. Does it mean anything for the bigger market?
Well, that's another interesting question. Yes, there's been a number of articles talking about the shift between growth and value. The growth has been outperforming value for a long time. It's, you know, you can really trace it all the way back to 2011. Really picked up steam in the last couple of years, 17, 18, and 19, and the spread between growth stocks and value stocks has really widened, and that's caused some analysts and some financial reporters to speculate that the rebound in value stocks and value stocks outperforming growth stocks implies some sort of doom for the market overall, or at least a pullback in the market overall. And we think that's an incorrect viewpoint. As a matter of fact, it's never really been true in the past. When value has outperformed growth or growth has outperformed value, there's been really no connection to future broad market returns. It hasn't really signaled anything. That's been the case for 50 years now. The real question is that does that signal a change in the relationship between value and growth and a change in that long-term trend that I mentioned? And on that, the jury's still out. There's a chance that value could resume, but you know, as long as we're in a high liquidity, slow growth environment, companies that can deliver earnings growth are going to continue to get most of the attention from investors.
Yeah, that makes sense. Great. Well, we cannot quite get away from politics. What about an impeachment inquiry, and what's it likely to do to the markets?
Yeah, that's always a tough question. There's bound to be some effect on equity market volatility as impeachment issues add just a little bit more cloudiness to the overall picture and distract attention away from other things. So investors might start to get worried about stability in Washington, but it's not something that can really be pinpointed, and we don't think it'll have a big directional impact. You know, as it stands now, there seems to be among most pundits, there seems to be little chance that anything would get through the Senate. So it's really just a bunch of talk, and in which case investors can probably divert their eyes from that and try to focus on market fundamentals.
Well, speaking of that, quarter end just passed us, and earnings season upon us. What's it look like?
Well, that's good. Good subject, Steve. The case this year has been that earnings growth has been flat for the first half of the year compared to the first half of last year, while we've been getting some growth in sales. So there's been a good bit of margin contraction, and you know, part of that is the roll-off of 2018 tax impacts. So now we're into 2019, and we don't have the big change in tax burdens from 2018 to 2019. And then part of that probably has to do with the strength in the labor market and wages rising, and maybe even some impacts from tariffs and things like that. So our top line growth has been okay, not super strong, but okay. Bottom line growth has been kind of weak, but the pattern has been recently that expectations have been pretty low, and then when the numbers finally come in, they've beaten expectations, and that, you know, that's the way we're starting off the earnings season for third quarter reports. Currently, the street is expecting about a decline of 4% or so in S&P 500 earnings, but an increase of about 3% in S&P 500 sales. Now, you know, I'm not suggesting that we have a strong idea that they're going to have a positive surprise again this this quarter, but that's been the pattern recently. And we have seen some other trends upward in economic expectations for the third quarter, so it could find its way into company earnings reports. The top line growth is really a good, it's sort of a good reassurance. We've had a lot of earnings weakness, but having good growth at the top line is a good reassurance that there's growth somewhere. It's just, as Paul talked about in great detail, it's just weaker than it has been for quite some time. And so it's been a challenge for investors to muddle through in 2019. But if they muddle through, if go back to Christmas last year, S&P 500's up almost 30%. So we've muddled through and delivered some pretty good returns in equity markets. Looking ahead, there's a pretty solid expectation among the analyst community that 2020 will be a rebound year and we'll get some decent earnings growth. Another part of that has to do with comparisons again. So the 2018 tax cut boost is now completely in the rearview mirror, and so the comparison from 2020 to 2019 will not have to worry about that. So we may see a return to decent growth in 2020. Evaluations are not overextended; they're a little on the high side, but they're not overextended compared to most of the recent past. So, you know, our expectation is probably more the same. A lot of volatility, some exogenous events affecting that volatility, but some healthy growth at the top line and maybe some improvement at the bottom line could lead to average returns for equities in the near future.
All right. Great. Something to definitely keep our eyes on. Thank you very much, Martin, and to all of our commentators today, and to all of you for joining. We apologize for running a little long, but there was a lot of news flow this month, as we said, and we hope you found the comments valuable. Please join us next month when we'll do our monthly update on November 5th. Thanks again.